right on his own. If you're a hard worker and do a good job, you deserve your pay. We don't call your wages a gift, but if you see that the job is too big for you, that it's something only God can do, and you trust him to do it, you could never do it for yourself, no matter how hard and long you worked. Well, that trusting him to do it is what gets you right with God, by God, a sheer gift. David confirms this
Wait,
way.
Is that right?
I couldn't remember.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Connie.
Oh yeah, I'm okay.
Nine. She's got to go through nine.
Yeah, mine does.
Yeah,
goes
yeah,
nine.
You're good.
David confirms this way of looking at it, saying that the one who trusts God to do the putting everything right without insisting on having a say in it is one fortunate man. Fortunate those whose crimes are carted off, whose sins are wiped clean from the slate. Fortunate the person against whom the Lord does not keep score. Do you think for a minute that this blessing is only pronounced over those who keep our religious ways and are circumcised? Or do you think it's possible that the blessing could be given to those who have never heard of our ways, who were never brought up in the disciplines of God? We all agree, don't we, that it is by embracing what God did for him that Abraham was declared fit before God.
Now think, was that declaration made before or after he was marked by the covenant rite of circumcision? That's right, before he was marked. That means that he underwent circumcision as evidence and confirmation of what God had done long before to bring him into this acceptable standing with himself, an act of God he had embraced with his whole life. And it means further that Abraham is father of all people who embrace what God does for them while they are still on the outs with God, as yet unidentified as God's in an uncircumcised condition. It is precisely these people in this condition who are called set right by God and with God. Abraham is also, of course, father of those who have undergone the religious rite of circumcision, not just because of the ritual, but because they are willing to live in the risky faith embrace of God's action for them, the way Abraham lived long before he was marked by circumcision.
That famous promise God gave Abraham that he and his children would possess the earth was not given because of something Abraham did or would do. It was based on God's decision to put everything together for him, which Abraham then entered when he believed. If those who get what God gives them only get it by doing everything they are told to do and filling out all the right forms properly signed, that eliminates personal trust completely and turns the promise into an ironclad contract. That's not a holy promise. That's a business deal. A contract drawn up by a hard-nosed lawyer and with plenty of fine print only makes sure that you will never be able to collect. But if there's no contract in the first place, simply a promise, and God's promise at that, you can't break it. This is why the fulfillment of God's promise depends entirely on trusting God and his way, and this simply embracing him and what he does. God's promise arrives as pure gift. That's the only way everyone can be sure to get in on it. Those who keep the religious tradition and those who have never heard of them. For Abraham is father of us all. He is not our racial father. That's reading the story backwards. He is our faith father.
We call Abraham father, not because he got God's attention by living like a saint, but because God made something out of Abraham when he was a nobody. Isn't that what we've always read in Scripture? God saying to Abraham, I set you up as father of many peoples. Abraham was first named father and then became a father because he dared to trust God to do what only God could do, raise the dead to life, with a word, make something out of nothing. When everything was hopeless, Abraham believed anyway, deciding to live not on the basis of what he saw he couldn't do, but on what God said he would do. And so he was made father of a multitude of peoples. God himself said to him, you're going to have a big family, Abraham. Abraham didn't focus on his own impotence and say, it's hopeless, this 100-year-old body could never father a child. Nor did he survey Sarah's decades of infertility and give up. He didn't tiptoe around God's promise, asking cautiously skeptical questions. He plunged into the promise and came up strong, ready for God, sure that God would make good on what he had said. That's why it is said Abraham was declared fit before God by trusting God to set him right. But it's not just Abraham, it's also us. The same thing gets said about us when we embrace and believe the one who brought Jesus to life when the conditions were equally hopeless. The sacrifice Jesus was made us fit for God, set us right with God.
Does that help?
I just want to read it again.
I know. It's a really beautiful way of putting that. I really like how Eugene Peterson does that. Here would be my suggestion as you read Romans 4, but as the rest of Romans, particularly when you come to a chapter that is difficult. I would say Romans 4 is probably your most straightforward, like, got it, no matter what you read it in. But some of these chapters are a little difficult. So after you've read it in a good translation, if it's difficult, then go to the message and see. Eugene Peterson's theology is usually right on track, so his wording is really good. It just might give you a little bit of understanding of the words that are in either your NAS or your ESV as you're reading that. So that's just a suggestion to help you with that. All that to say, I want to start with our review, and I want to really get a good review under our belt so we understand, particularly since we're in chapter 4. And that means that we have finished, or we will finish today, one section of Paul's Romans whole letter. Remember, he pares it down into four sections of four chapters. So this is one section, and this is that section that we called under Rejecting the Glory. Remember, so the whole title of this Romans 1 through 8 is Receiving a Righteousness That Honors God's Glory. And under that, we have two sections, right? 1 through 4, 5 through 8. So 1 through 4 is where we are at today, and that is all about rejecting God's glory. So we'll put that up here, and we'll say, okay, so what have we learned about rejecting God's glory? So I'm going to give you what Paul has been trying to do. And all along, what Paul's been trying to do is say, you have all these unfaithful ways of living. You live a life that is disconnected to God, disconnected from God, and you live unfaithfully. But in all of those, I want to show you that God lives faithfully, that God is faithful. And so he contrasts those in each chapter. So I want us to see that so that we understand what Paul is trying to do, trying to get at, what kind of a life we have without God and what kind of life we have with God. So the first thing he does in the context and with the beginning of chapter 1, right, 1 through 17, we see that humans have this context of an honor-shame paradigm. No matter when you lived, there's always an honor-shame paradigm. In fact, every culture has some way of embracing an honor-shame context. So we embrace it, and we embrace it fully. And I don't think you can even argue that there isn't a culture that doesn't embrace it, right? I mean, we're always seeking honor. We're going to talk a lot more about how we specifically seek honor. And I'm going to give you, I think, today some opportunities to share how you found yourself seeking honor. So hopefully you've been thinking about that. Hopefully you've been doing your little material unraveling. So in an honor-shame culture, in a way that we do that, God, instead of seeking honor and shame, he bestows honor. We seek honor, which means we want to take it for ourselves. But God does just the opposite. He bestows honor. And that, and in chapter 1, 1 through 16, 1 through 17, we see that because Paul actually receives that, right, as a model. He says, the Lord has made me a privileged servant. He's given me that privilege. Not because Paul was great, right? In fact, Paul was just the opposite. God gives him that. And so Paul says, although we're looking to find honor for ourselves, God bestows honor undeservedly. He just, that's who he is. So it's always this contrast between our unfaithfulness and his faithfulness. When we get to the second part of chapter 1, we notice that we suppress the truth and exchange glory, right? So that's our key of what we saw, how we are. And what does it mean when we talk, when we say suppressing the truth, exchanging the glory? What do we mean by that? What do we mean by suppressing the truth?
That we don't agree that God is all in power.
It's not just that we, it's not that we don't agree, it's that we're trying to, we don't want people to know it. We don't want to think that God is God. We don't want to think that I have someone over me that actually is in control and has the right to order what is good and what is not. So that's suppressing the truth. What's exchanging glory? And if you don't know this, you completely don't know Romans. What does it mean to exchange glory?
We don't take the glory he gave us as images of God. And we worship the created things rather than God.
So, what's when God gave us glory, it was to
create, name and
right, rule, right, and relate, right, just like him.
Yeah.
We're supposed to rule as his representatives. That's what it means. Glory is always talks about authority. It's not light. It is all. It's a metonym, right, which means it's talking about a role of authority. God has given us the role of authority, and we've exchanged it. We've said, yeah, not so much. Don't want that. I would rather have my emotions satisfied. I would rather have my body satisfied. I would rather have the form of creation rule me rather than me rule it. So that's to exchange glory. God says, but I am creating you, I'm giving you glory, I'm creating you to be kin and kings. That's how the Jewish, the Hebrew would say it. And so while we exchange glory, while we say, yeah, don't want that glory, God says, I want to give you glory. I actually created you to have my glory, to have my authority. If you don't remember that, I think that you need to come up with some way to remember glory is authority. Glory is authority. When I'm given God's glory, I'm given his authority to rule here on earth. Rule my form, rule the form of creation so that it flourishes for God's purpose. So, chapter 1, 1 through 17, humans unfaithfully seek honor on their own while God bestows honor without it being deserved. Chapter 1, 18 through 32, we exchange the glory, but God gives us glory so that we are not only kin related to him in relationship, but also representative rulers. Everybody got that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we get into chapter 2, and we see that what we do is we want to try to exempt ourselves from judgment. Yeah, we've exchanged glory, but we don't want the judgment that comes with that. So we try to exempt ourselves. And this is where the questioner came in, right? Well, shouldn't some of us be exempt from judgment? Because didn't God make us this way? Whatever way that is. And I love that the Jewish man says, but you made us to be your people. But we could say it anyway. Well, you made us to be a certain way. You made us to really like food. So isn't it your fault? I mean, doesn't that sound like a familiar,
yes.
Right?
No.
It goes right to, back to Genesis 3, right?
Yes.
It's your fault. You made us this way, so we should be exempt from judgment.
You made a male or female.
So, we feel we should be exempt from judgment, but God says, but I judge you for your good. I judge you to make space for what is good. That's why I judge you. And, you know, I've been reading a lot about, you know, how people just don't like a God who would. So this week there was a big article on David Bentley Hart. Do you know who he is?
Say it again.
David Bentley Hart is a progressive. He's a Christian. He's written his own translation of the New Testament. And his basic theology is there can't be any such thing as an eternal hell. Because how could a loving God judge? So that's a big thing. And a big idea. And yet we think that judgment is a bad thing. We say, because we're here, we exchange our glory, so we decide that judgment is a bad thing. So we want to exempt ourselves. And God says, no, wait, I'm actually trying to rid your life of what doesn't bring life. Mm-hmm. I am a doctor who says, I judge you to have cancer. Do you say, well, that's a bad thing. Why should you tell me that I have cancer? Why should you tell me I have something bad in my body? Mm-hmm. I mean, how many of us would do that? How many of us would go to a doctor and a doctor says, I've determined that you have cancer? And how many would say,
fine, I'll keep it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Or say, how dare you tell me that? You don't have a right to tell me that. You're being mean. And what does that sound like?
A child.
A child, exactly. God says, no, I judge you to make space for life. Because what I'm judging is bringing death.
I keep thinking of the pruning.
Of the pruning. Absolutely, right? Absolutely, the pruning. So we have chapter 1. Chapter 2, and last week we had chapter 3, where what chapter 3 told us was that we're all powerless under sin. And yet, of course, the questioner says, I'm going to deflect that. I'm not powerless. There might be a lot of people who are powerless, but I'm not powerless because I really have control of my life. Mm-hmm. I really know what I'm doing, right? Mm-hmm. And Paul says, first of all, we all think that way. It's not a good thing, right? You are deflecting your powerlessness, and when you deflect your powerlessness, when you refuse to say, I can't bring myself life, what happens? If you can't admit that you can't bring life, you're never going to seek out where you can get life, right? God says, I have power, and I have power to actually take you out of that place. And you refuse to say that you don't have power to do that. Thus, you will never look to me. So my power is a power to redeem. That's where we've been so far in rejecting glory. We embrace honor, shame. We exchange our glory. We try to exempt ourselves from judgment. We deflect our powerlessness. And this week, in chapter 4, we're going to see that we are always trying to avoid death. We're always trying to avoid the death of the life that we live here, rejecting glory, right?
But when we deflect our powerlessness, we wither away because we're not looking to the source of life.
Of course.
I know it sounds like obvious, but I live this.
And that's Paul's whole emphasis is, there isn't one of us that don't fit under here. He says, we all fit under here. In the midst of that, God continues to be faithful to us. He continues to bestow honor. He continues to create us as King of Kings. He continues to judge us, which is a good thing. He continues to want to offer his power to redeem. And today, what we're going to see is that we, although we always try to avoid death, God says, but I'll go with you in that death. And when I go with you, I'm going to take on the burden of that part of death for you, so that yes, we still need to go through the death of the life that we have on our own, but God will take that burden with you. So I've already given you the whole punchline of today, because I want you to see how much Paul is saying your unfaithfulness will get you nowhere. Your unfaithfulness will not get you life, but all along God remains faithful. And his faithfulness is the only thing that will actually get you life. And when I say get you life, allow you to be the full human that you were created to be. And so we're going to go into that a little bit as we look at Romans 4. So that's kind of the review of rejecting glory. After we come home from our field trip, in 2 weeks, we'll start up with the second section of Romans 1 through 8. So we'll get 5 through 8, which is, hope of glory. Got to think about that. So we're going to talk about that. Oh, so then what is that glory that we're actually hoping for that is assured. So that's kind of the review of where we've been. So then what about Abraham? So it's kind of, it might seem kind of weird for us as Paul starts to talk about Abraham and has a whole chapter on Abraham. What about Abraham? What does he add to the argument that our unfaithfulness doesn't get us life, but God's faithfulness does? What does he add to that? So you need to know a little bit of the context of why Paul would bring this up. So this is a Jewish question. Although we know that Christians also, at the time, would have considered Abraham their father. But the question really becomes a Jewish question in that, in the Jewish writings, so at the time, Jewish scribes were writing a lot of things. Some things we would call midrash, and a midrash is a commentary on scripture. So it's kind of an explanation. It's kind of like Eugene Peterson writing Romans 4 in the Message to just say, here, you don't understand this. Let me make it easier for you. So the Jews had a lot of writings trying to explain that. A lot of those writings became what we know as Apocrypha. So some of our Bibles include that. And one of the pieces of Apocrypha that are in some Bibles is the book of Sirach. And so in the book of Sirach, actually retells Abraham's story. And so this was what the Jews at the time were really understanding about Abraham's story. So you need to understand that so you understand why Paul is adamant about answering this kind of a question. So in Sirach, it condenses Abraham's story. It gives a condensed version of it. And what it does is it highlights Abraham's faithfulness, which I think is interesting. Why does Eugene Peterson say in his Message, this story is about, what does he say? God's faithfulness, not Abraham's faithfulness. So it's as if he's trying to address this book of Sirach. So the book of Sirach says, we're going to highlight Abraham's faithfulness, and we're going to do it basically in three things. We're going to say Abraham left everything for God. So we know he left Haran, first Ur and then Haran, because God called him out. So it highlights that. Secondly, it highlights Abraham's submission to circumcision, which would have been a big deal, right? Because at the time of he was circumcised, he was old, really old, right? 95, I think, when he got circumcised. So it highlights that's a huge piece of Abraham's faithfulness. And the third piece of Abraham's life it will highlight is Abraham's sacrificing Isaac. So those are all big pieces, right? Leaving everything for a God he doesn't know, being circumcised at age 95, and then sacrificing Isaac. Those three things are what Sirach highlights as, thus, Abraham is so faithful. And in fact, Sirach says, therefore, because Abraham was so faithful, Abraham actually deserves the reward of right standing. That's what Sirach says. Interesting, right? And so that's what the Jews of the time Paul's writing are, they're writing these kinds of things. And this is how they're condensing the story. It's basically to say, so this happened to me this week. I'm sitting outside doing my study. I'm at the table there. And right in front of the table walks a coyote.
No. What?
Oh my word.
And the coyote, and I just stop thinking, I don't want to move. I don't want this coyote to be startled. So I could tell you the story about the coyote. I could tell you about the fact that it stayed in our yard for a while. It went behind the bushes. It went to the neighbors. Dogs started barking at it, little dogs.
Yeah,
it ran to a playground. I could tell you all of that. And it really wouldn't matter to you how I told you, because I've told you the essence of the story, right? Mm-hmm. A coyote came within a foot and a half of me in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. And he was really large, probably one of the largest coyotes I've seen.
School was in session.
So I could tell you that story, and it wouldn't matter if I told you exactly when each thing happened, right? Because the essence is a coyote is in my yard.
Mm-hmm. And you were outside.
And I was outside, yeah, yeah. So I could tell you lots about that story, but I've told you the highlights, and it doesn't matter. Sirach, that's how Sirach does. I'm just telling you the highlights, and it doesn't matter how I tell you a story. But if I told you a different kind of a story...
You went into the schoolyard and attacked a child.
If I told you a different kind of story, where the sequence was very important, then it would matter how I told the story, right? So at the time, the Jewish writers are just saying, the important thing about Abraham is that he was faithful. Kind of putting it upside down, right? Because the important thing about the story is that God is faithful. Mm-hmm. And so the Jews are saying in response then to chapter 3, to the end of chapter 3, which of course Paul is making up, this is what the Jews would say. Chapter 3 asserted that Jesus died to bring us into right standing because we couldn't get into right standing. But the Jews would say, but Abraham doesn't need that death because he was able to be in right standing on his own. Right? So that's what the Jews are saying. Well, what about Abraham? What does Abraham show us? What does Abraham show us about his flesh? That would be the translation there. About his ability to do works of righteousness so that he was, oh yeah, he's righteous because he's done all these works because he's been so obedient. So the obedience was a big deal. And why? Because they had already taken the scriptures and manipulated them, right? So what Paul wants to say is, look, I need to refute what you're saying here. I need to refute that you think that there are some people, like Abraham, who really doesn't need the death of Jesus because he can actually get righteousness on his own. Because if Abraham can get righteousness on his own, well, then there must be other people. But of course, it can only be people under Abraham. And if you tell that story, you're actually telling a lie about God. You're saying that God isn't faithful to what he said, that he is bringing people into righteousness by faith and not by words. And so for the Jews to say this was a false teaching. It was doctrine that could not be disseminated, and so Paul has to refute this. They're maligning God's character, right? They're saying that God is untrustworthy. And if he's untrustworthy in this promise about bringing people into righteousness by faith, then he's going to be untrustworthy in everything.
They're refuting God's truth.
Exactly. They're suppressing the truth, right? And that's exactly what Paul is trying to tell them, is we need to refute this. But the second reason he needs to do this is because the Jews are manipulating the sequence of God's story to fit their own purpose, right? Their purpose is, so they couldn't get through, we should be exempted from judgment because this is how you made us, you made us your people. Now they're trying a backdoor approach, right? Well, our father Abraham was so obedient that God called him righteous. But that matters, that statement, right? Is it Abraham was so obedient that God called him righteous, or was it God called him righteous and he became obedient? So we're going to have to examine then the sequence of Abraham's story. Because in reality, the sequence of Abraham's story tells a different story, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. But we tell the wrong story. To our children,
right?
I'm thinking through every single children's Bible story. We tell it from the person's point of view, not God's. And how different would it be if we changed it to from God's story?
Always. Yes.
Why? It is told that way. Some curriculum.
Just trying to put myself in their shoes, knowing Old Testament, the prophecies of the Messiah, like why Messiah if you can gain righteousness as Abraham did?
Because again, they watered down what Messiah would be, that Messiah would be an earthly king, true, that would rule only Israel to make Israel the most superior and powerful. So what if they've already manipulated it to be fitting in the honor shame, right? So when once you do that, and that's why that's the whole context, once you submit and embrace to an honor-shame paradigm, you will have to begin to manipulate everything, right? Which is why all of these happen. So that's why Israel would have done that. They would have had to make sure that their paradigm of honor-shame is going to fit this. Their paradigm of being superior is going to have to fit this, which I would say I see really no difference with the Christian culture today. We so much want to be the superior ones because we still are embracing the honor-shame paradigm. And God says, well, wait, I'm bestowing honor on you. You're not getting it for yourself. So to think about yourself as superior says that anybody else I bring in, you're going to check out on your own little paradigm list. So Paul's very adamant about this because his whole idea is you've got to see one another as same value as everybody else because I'm the one who gives value. I'm the one who bestows honor. So when the Jewish reading manipulates the sequence of God's story, it promotes not receiving God's invitation as given, right? Which is how we started Romans. Remember these jars here? So
that's looking pretty yucky.
Ah, no mold yet, but what's happening? It's getting soft and yeah, kind of slimy. Yeah,
is that a kiwi or is that a lime?
They're limes, and they were all this color.
Oh, that brown one was
yes.
Too? I haven't touched this.
It is not a kiwi.
It is lime. Now
it's turning into a kiwi.
To be honest,
that doesn't look like much is happening.
Not much is happening. There is like this tiny, tiny little greenness coming, but not much is happening still. So I might be tempted, and I have been tempted every single day. I got to plant some in there. Right? So it looks like I want it to look. But still, this isn't looking great. This is starting to not look great. But I could do this, right?
I did that one.
Yeah.
But how perfect how, like, with the right side, it's like, well, we did everything right, God, so there should be something.
And have you not? I have literally said that to God. In my deepest and darkest moments of my life, I have said to God, God, I've done everything right for you. What's the deal? And boy, I got a reaming out. Mm-hmm. But the way that Jesus does it, right? He says, oh, really? That's all he needed to say. So this is Paul then needing to respond. He wants to refute this Jewish idea because it's not just a Jewish idea, right? He wants to refute it to show both the Jews and the Gentiles that God's faithfulness is the only answer to our unfaithfulness. And only it's the only avenue to restoring us to our full humanity. God's faithfulness is the only avenue to restoring us to our full humanity. So, what then does an Abrahamic faith look like? An Abrahamic faith, first of all, responds to God's faithfulness. This is the story of God's faithfulness to Abraham. So I want you to turn to Genesis 12. We're going to really examine Abraham's story and see what is the true sequence. What's the sequence that God has given us about his story, when things happened, and what exactly did happen? So Genesis 12. So if you know no other chapters in the Old Testament, Genesis 12 through Genesis 15 are the chapters you must know. They are so essential. I would say that most, if we've been in study long enough, we know these chapters. So this will be a review for a lot of you, but you need to know these and you need to understand the sequence of Abraham's, at this point, Abram's life. So Genesis 12, somebody read Genesis 12, 1 and 2.
Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing.
Okay. So we have then, here is the beginning of Abram's, of God's faithfulness to Abram, to which he responds. That is, number one, God calls Abram out. God is always the initiator for life by calling us to his life. He is always the initiator. So he asks Abram to leave country, relatives, and father's house. If he's to leave his country, it means he leaves his place, his space, where he actually is comfortable. He asks him to leave his relatives, his family. And he asks him to leave his father's house, which actually means his position. Because remember, in ancient Near Eastern living, everyone lives in their father's house. So that's why when Jesus talks about, I have a house with many rooms, right? Mm-hmm. In the ancient Near East, you would have a house, and when your son or daughter, when your son got married, you would build onto that house. So sons didn't get to go off on their own and build their own house. They built onto that house because the patriarch, the father, remained the patriarch, even of a married son. Even if the married son is 80 years old and the father is 100 years old, the son is still under the father. So when he says, leave your father's house, he's saying, leave your position. Leave who you are as far as your role is concerned. So you're leaving your place, your family, and your position. That's what he's asking him to do. Unlike us today, we would go, woohoo! Sounds great, I can be on my own, right? But that's only a manifestation of all of this. So he asks them to do that, and he says, I'm going to show you what I'm about to give you. I'm about to give you your own land, an environment where you can flourish. I'm about to give you your own family that will join you as helpers. I'm about to give you a purpose and a function, a role. And that is a role of expanding the blessing I'm going to give you. Carry and expand that blessing of that place of flourishing and that family. So he's telling him, leave all of these things so that you have space for what I want to give you. And that is a land where you can flourish, a family that can help you out, and a role, a position, a purpose, a function. I hope that for you, you immediately jump to Genesis 1 and 2, because that's all it's doing. This is recreation. He's doing exactly what he did in Genesis 1 and 2. I'm creating a place where humanity can function. I'm creating helpers for that humanity, and I'm giving that humanity a function and a purpose. That's all he's doing with Abram. He's recreating humanity with a people. And then, of course, he confirms his promise to Abram later on in 12. He says, I'm going to show Abraham the land. And he says, I'm going to show you the land, and this land I will give you. So one of the things you might want to do is, if you're on your own, is looking through these verses and through anything that's talking about Abraham, New Testament or Old, is look at the word give. It is over and over and over again. And it's God giving to Abraham the new humanity. So that's 12, 1 through 9. We get then to 12, 10 through 20. And without reading all of this, I would love to just read all through Genesis. Does anyone know what the story is? Let me start with just 10. Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. Anybody know what happens?
Yeah, they lied about he pretends his wife.
Okay.
He doesn't cause trouble. Yeah. And
he tells a half-truth, because she's his half-sister.
Okay. But remember how God judges? Let's read that those one sentences. So Abram talks, it's always confusing, right? His name is Abram here, and his wife's name is Sarai here. I want you to read verse
17.
So let's read 11 through 13. Somebody read that loudly.
As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai,
I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you.
Okay. What's the motivation?
Self-preservation.
But even before self-preservation, you see what he says? Please say that you are my sister so that it may go well with me. Mm-hmm. So that I may
prosper,
get honor, right? Mm-hmm. So what we have here is when Abram received the invitation to go out, right? Which is what Sirach says, Abraham is faithful. He's obedient because he left his home. But he doesn't receive the invitation as given. Because the invitation is, I'm going to supply you with an abundant life. Completely new life, and it's going to be abundant. But what's the first thing he does? He chooses to protect himself and increase his own honor. Oh, that was nice, God. I'm glad you promised me that. Right now, I need to be worried about where I'm at. And I need to get some honor for myself. I need to accumulate some riches. And I need to make sure that I protect myself. So he has received the invitation, but not as given, right? Because the invitation was, come and go where I show you, and I'm going to give you. Meaning, don't start taking for yourself. Which again is a review of Genesis 3. Right? God says, here's the abundance. Eat everything. Don't take anything. Eat everything I give you. And of course, we know that both Adam and Eve take rather than receive what's given.
He also took Lot. So that was also.
Okay, we're getting there, right? So he chooses to protect himself and increase his own honor. Rather than wait for God to provide it. Despite God's lavish promise to honor him with more than enough, right? A land, a family, and a purpose. That's everything. Everything you need for life. Abraham plans to lie about Sarai, right? So that it will go well with me and so that I may live on. But he does even more than that. He asks Sarai to be involved in it too, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, we have reflection of Genesis 3, mm-hmm. roles reversed. But we also have Romans 1, because the end of Romans 1 says, you've exchanged your glory and you've done all these things, but what's the end of, do you remember what the end of Romans 1 is? You entice others to do it too. Mm-hmm. And so we have Abram doing the exact same thing. He entices now Sarai to do this. And how does he entice Sarai to do this? What does he say?
You're so beautiful.
You're so beautiful. Say you're my sister so that it would go well with me because of you. And that I may live on account of you. Mm-hmm. What's he doing here? He's trying to honor her falsely, right? And in honoring her falsely, he is then taking the credit away from whom? Yeah. Which is what he's doing the whole time, which is what exchanging glory is all about. Taking the credit away from God, being God. God said, I'll give you an abundant life. Yeah, that's nice, Lord, but while I'm waiting, I'm going to get my abundant life for myself. And I'm going to make sure somebody else comes and does it with me. And I'm going to do it by honoring her falsely, flattering her, right? So that she feels like, oh, she's the one who actually brought me life. So we are ready. One lie goes to another and goes to another. And so, what happens in that story? Pharaoh eventually takes Sarah as his wife, which all that means is he brings him into the harem. She will come up eventually for her conjugal visits, but she has not yet. And in the midst of that, there has to be an intervention, right?
Yep.
Because Abraham can't do anything about it now. He's committed to, well, she's not my wife, and so now Pharaoh's taken. Think about what he gives in order to get honor for himself. And as ugly as that is, Paul wants us to know, that's how ugly your stuff is. You will give up someone so that you can have honor.
Well, even the woman that is to give you your heir, I mean, I know they're older and they doubt whatever, but like, it's even more than just your loved one or your closest. It's like,
yes, right? So completely messed up. But Paul, and when Paul mentions Genesis 15, he's actually mentioning the whole story of Abram. So we need to know this, right? So who has to intervene?
God,
of course, has to intervene. He has to rescue him. And he does so, of course, by bringing a plague on Pharaoh. And, of course, all the ancient Egyptians would have known any plague is always from some god who is angry. Mm-hmm. And so Pharaoh knows, oh, wait a second. You must be angry because I just took Sarai as a wife. What's going on? And of course, he discovers what's going on. And how happy do you think he is with Abram? Mm-hmm. Not so happy, right? And so he throws Abram out, but he doesn't kill him because God, who brought a plague, is powerful. So he's not going to do that. So God rescues Abram from his own disordered way of getting honor, right? Every time we seek honor for ourselves, it's disordered. So that's chapter 12. Chapter 13 and 14, we go on. God has to deliver Abram again. So we have here 13:1. Chris, since you brought it up, read just verse 1.
So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him.
Okay. So Abraham received the invitation, but he didn't receive it as given. Number one, that God was going to give him an abundant life, not himself. And number two, he said, leave what? What were the three things he was to leave?
Relatives.
Your relatives. Use that word relative, because that'll come up. So leave your place, leave your relatives, and leave your position. So he chooses to bring Lot with him, which is why when you look at Genesis 13 and 14 from here on in, every time they mention Lot, they will say, Lot, your relative. Why? Why is Lot always...
Drive home the point.
Abram, you were supposed to leave your relatives, and you brought one along. Which says, God says to Abram, I'm going to give you your own relatives. I'm going to give you your own family. You have no need to bring any family with you. But maybe. And here's my guess. At this point, Abram is 75, probably 76, 77... He has had no children yet. And he's thinking already, wow. I better bring somebody out in my family so that I can have some kind of progeny, right? Mm-hmm. Probably what he's thinking. I don't know any other reason why he would have brought Lot with him. But he does.
It could have been really close.
He could have been really close, except that what happens in this chapter, we know, of course, the families grow, and now... there becomes tension between Lot's family and Abram's family, right? And now Abram is forced to instigate a separation. Oh. Lot chooses to live in the well-watered Valley of Jordan, which is where Sodom and Gomorrah happened to be, which is where he ends up. Once he separates, God then comes back to Abram and says, I'm going to confirm to you this land is going to be yours. I'm giving this to you. But he doesn't do it until after he separates from Lot. That's an interesting point, that God doesn't confirm it until he actually separates from Lot. But although Lot separates, he's living differently, what happens to Lot?
He's captured in war.
He's captured in war, right? So there's four the most powerful kings of that area go to war with the five other kings. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and three other places. They all go to war, and Lot gets captured. And this is where the writer says, thus, Abram needed to rescue his relative Lot. And so Abram now is pulled into a war against four powerful kingdoms. He's got to rescue his relative, which as the reader, we should be going, oh, he's got to rescue his relative? Oh, yeah. His relative wouldn't be here except that Abram changed the invitation to include somebody else, right? And I mean, as soon as you write that, you think, oh, yeah, Like when you get an invitation, and I've heard this all the time, particularly for weddings. Mm-hmm. Where's Linda? Is Linda here? Mm-hmm. Linda, have you gotten any responses that you, somebody's bringing somebody that they weren't invited?
Not this time.
Not this time. Oh, good. Because that happens all the time, right? Michelle,
time.
You just got one?
The baby shower. Showed up. Stupid.
Yeah, so you have an invitation, you send it out, it's to Mr. and Mrs. whomever, and they write back, I'm bringing a guest. Mm-hmm. Or they just put three. Mm-hmm. That's what Abram did, right? He was given an invitation to him and Sarah, and Abram went, plus one. And that plus one,
I think I would call and ask for
Abram would not be in the spot of where now he's in a war and he has to defend his relative, except that he changed the invitation. So when we think about these things, about changing the invitation, it's a big deal. It will get us into places that we weren't ever intended to be. And so, of course, we have Abram and he wins the war. Does he win it on his own?
No.
How do we know that?
Says it in it, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. When he goes, when he finishes and he goes to Melchizedek, Melchizedek and he both agree it is God who has delivered you.
Right.
God again had to deliver him, but this time on a much bigger scale. And so he delivers them, and he also now, unlike with the place with Sarah where he's going to tell Sarah, well, Sarah, it's because of you I'm getting life. Now he says to God and to Melchizedek, and to the king of Salem, or the king of Sodom, it is not because of me that I got life. It is actually because of God. And the king of Sodom says, you've done us such a great favor. Here's all the treasures that you can take. And Abram says, I don't want to take any because I don't want you ever to come back saying that I have life, I have riches, I have this abundant life because you gave me the start, because it is God who gave it to me. So we see Abram's faith is changing, right? It's, yes, he's gone and call out, but he's changed the invitation. And he still changes the invitation, but now he sees, oh, but it is God who's actually giving me life here. So what we're seeing is Abram having experiences of God's faithfulness in the midst of his unfaithfulness. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the story we have so far with Abram. So we get now to Genesis 15, which is the center of Paul's argument. And here we have God addressing Abram's disorders. And he does so by coming alongside of him. So let's look at those disorders. Somebody read 15, just 15:1.
After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great.
Okay. So what we first see is God knows that Abram is afraid. Why is he afraid? And this is why it always bothers me if we look at Genesis 15 without looking at Genesis 13 and 14. Why is Abram afraid?
Because he hasn't been faithful.
Mm-hmm. Let's just think humanly.
Oh.
What's going on?
There's all these other kings around.
He just came out of a war, and he's old. And
he just came out of a war where he defeated, but he did not kill the four kings. Mm-hmm. It says that he pushed them as far as the north of Damascus.
Right.
There are four kings out there who've just been defeated. They live in an honor-shame society. Mm-hmm. What do you think Abram's afraid of? They're going to look for vengeance because they have been shamed. They're going to come after him. You think Abram has reason to be afraid? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Humanly speaking, yes. Abraham is afraid. He is actually, what's happening here is the writer is saying Abraham is allowing his emotions to get the best of him, right? That's how we would say it. Genesis would say, you're allowing your emotions to rule you. So we know that Abram's afraid. He's defeated these four kings. He knows they might come back for their honor. But God says, you don't have to be afraid with me by your side. There's no need to be afraid. You don't have to be ruled by that fear. Secondly, we see that God says, I am a shield to you. Abraham knows that he can't defend himself. Karen said he's old at this point. He's been through a war. at this point. He's exhausted. And his thoughts have been playing the scenario over and over again. Okay, now what am I going to do? There's just no way I can defend myself. He knows this because he hasn't been able to defend himself for the last 10 years, right? Because every time God has to intervene. And so his thoughts are, I can't defend myself. He's had experience with this, but God says to him, but I am a shield to you. I'm going to be your very capable defender. And this is a scenario his thoughts have not come up with, because when we're disconnected from God, we don't think that we can count on God rescuing us again. He rescued me in Egypt, and he rescued me in the Valley of Jordan. I can't, this is my mind thinking, I can't depend on him again, can I? That's I've asked already too much of him. So his thoughts are, I can't defend myself. And God says, but I am a shield to you. I am actually your defender. And then lastly, we see that God says, your reward shall be very great. Now we have to understand A&E culture to understand this. What Abraham believes is that he's missing a great reward, that he has not had a reward. Now he's not talking about the treasures and booty that came from the war. Because for an A&E person, what is the greatest reward?
To have children.
To have children, right?
To have a family.
Because to have children for an A&E person means my life is carried on. Mm-hmm. It is what we would consider eternal life. Remember, they don't think that they actually live past the grave. They believe their children allows them to live past the grave. So that way, children are the greatest thing life can offer you, is to have children. And Abram knows that his body is telling him, you don't have a great reward. You have no reward. You have nothing from this life. That you don't have the greatest honor that life could actually give you. I do think that's interesting, and I would love to go there, because I think the fact of how Abram and all of A&E would have seen children is completely opposite of how we see children today, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to calculate if you can afford them.
Yes,
and then
right.
Abort them if you
yes.
don't want them.
So we have these ideas of children very different than we have here. So God says to him, I'm going to supply you with a very great reward, not just a reward. And that the reward there is inheritance, not wage for your good job, but an inheritance, children, and all the honor that accompanies it. So the more children you had, the more honor you had. And we think back to when we studied Job, right, when he lost all his children. That was devastating, not just on an emotional level, which is the only way we think about children, right? Mm-hmm. But on an honor level. And all the honor that accompanies that. Because as your children grow and have children, it extends your name out. It extends your life out. So God says, I'm going to supply you with an inheritance that is greater than you could have produced. So what I want to do is then look at the story of Abram, as we've done in Genesis, and then flip to Romans. To Romans 4, and show you that that's what Paul is doing. What Paul intends us to do is to integrate the story of Abram with his commentary. And he just gives a very short commentary. Is basically in Romans 4, 1 through 3, he says, see, Abraham can't boast about anything. I mean, he's wanting you to know the story, and he's going, see, Abraham can't boast. Look what he's done. He's been unfaithful. God has been the one who's been faithful. God hasn't justified Abraham because he's been faithful, because in fact, Abraham has not been faithful. And so right away, he's refuting this idea that Sirach has brought up. Romans 4 says, Abraham believed God. And that word there means to credit God as God. I believe that God is God. I'm honoring, and he does this when he honors God with his deliverance. Yes, you are the God of heaven and earth. You possess everything. And God receives that and assigns him a new status of righteousness. So that's all Paul really wants to say, is he's just gonna insert his little commentary on, see what I said? See what I mean? So when you read Romans 4, it's really a commentary inserted into Abram's story. So, that type of faith that Abram has, an Abrahamic faith, is a response to God's faithfulness. God always initiates by being faithful, and then faith is to respond to that. But secondly, an Abrahamic faith receives the necessity of death under God's faithfulness. What I mean by death, then, always means the death of the life that you had, the death of the life that you were in control of, the death of the life where you live in an honor-shame and you embrace an honor-shame paradigm, where you exchange glory, where you think you're exempt from judgment. That life, that has to die. That has to be rid of. So in Genesis 15, we go back to this. We have Genesis 15:2 saying, Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless? This is a statement to say, I cannot produce life. I'm childless. I cannot get honor for myself, and honor for my life can't continue because I'm going to have to give my inheritance, he says, to someone who is in my house, someone who is not my bloodline. My heir will be Eliezer of Damascus. Abraham says this twice. My heir will be someone who's not from my own body. I can't produce life for myself. This is something I can't do. I can't do anything about bringing life. It's under God's control because he says, what will you give me? You have not given me any offspring. Again, we have that word give. It's in your control, God, not mine. And this is a huge statement of, I can't produce life. Even though I'm trying to get honor for myself, even though I'm exchanging the glory and trying to let my mind rule, my emotions rule, my body rule, it's not bringing me life because it hasn't brought me the greatest reward of life, and that is children. We go back to Romans 4, 5 through 8, and Paul says, Abraham believed that God justifies the ungodly, which he means to say, Abraham believes himself to be ungodly. Right? That's why Abraham believes that God justifies the ungodly. And if you know you're ungodly, particularly an Old Testament figure, you know that you're headed toward death. If you're ungodly, you don't have life. And then Paul has David affirm the exact same thing, which is Psalm 32, which is what you did in your groups today, right? And so I'm glad because you read the whole thing, you understand that although Paul picks out what the result is, what is the thing that has to come before the blessing of being forgiven?
Acknowledgement,
right? A death to what you thought would bring you life. I thought this would bring me life. I was trying to get honor. My ways must go. They do not bring life. So this confession of David, which is beautiful, right? In fact, I think we need to read it. Read, somebody read Psalm 32:3.
When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away, through my groaning all day long.
Keep on.
For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as a fever heat of summer.
So Paul is saying, David says, when I keep silent about my life, when I say, hey, everything's going great, I'm getting life, I'm doing well, what happens? My body wastes away. I start dying. Mm-hmm. I start saying, oh yes, this is a good way to live. This is a good way to live. And remember, David is saying this after his sin with Bathsheba. Yep, this is a good way to live. I got what I wanted. I let my emotions and my body drive me. And when I keep hiding that as if that get satisfied me, my body wastes away. I begin to die. Both Abraham and David say, yeah, death has to come to this life. This life where I think I have to get my honor, where I am going to let my body rule me, that has to die. I have to acknowledge and confess, agree. Confess always means to agree with God that sin requires death. I have to allow God to take that away, that death deserves to be taken away, not just deserves, but needs to, so that I can have life. And that's when I am able to be revived. So to know the necessity of death, for faith, knowing and accepting the necessity of death, is to recognize my own poverty. It's to give up on the ways that I try to get life for myself, the ways I try to seek honor for myself. Admitting that my efforts are not only futile, but dangerous. When I seek to satisfy my own cravings, when I seek honor for myself, when I seek superiority, right? We've talked about this. This is what your whole unraveling material thing is about. And I hope that you're continuing to do that, because if we have time, I'm going to give you some time to express what's going on. So, of course, I've been working on that too. And every night I go through, so, Lord, where did I seek honor for myself? And there's been one or maybe 2 days where I think, I don't think I sought honor for myself. And then this week,
tenfold, huh?
I didn't even want to admit it, of course. And then the devotion for yesterday was Henry Nouwen. So let me read the devotion from Henry Nouwen and realize, oh, there's a place. Oof, that hurts. This hurts. So Henry says, I have often said, I forgive you. But even as I said these words, my heart remained angry or resentful. I still wanted to hear the story that I was right after all. I still wanted to hear apologies and excuses. I still wanted the satisfaction of receiving some praise in return, even if the praise was only about me being so forgiving. But God's forgiveness is unconditional. It comes from a heart that does not demand anything for itself. A heart that is completely empty of self-seeking. It is this divine forgiveness that I need to practice in my daily life. It calls me to keep stepping over all my arguments that say forgiveness is unwise, unhealthy, and impractical. It challenges me to step over all my needs for gratitude and compliments. Finally, it demands of me that I step over that wounded part of my heart that feels hurt and wronged, and that wants to stay in control and put a few conditions between me and the one whom I am asked to forgive.
Did you see the story this week of the man who forgave the woman who shot his brother?
Yes. But the point I want you to see here is there are places in our life that we think we're doing well, right? And this is exactly where I was this week. Mm-hmm. And it's even hard to talk about, because it's really hard to forgive when you've been hurt so badly. Mm-hmm. And when Henry wrote these, I just thought, that's exactly what I've been thinking. I want to hear just a little praise. Mm-hmm. I want to hear, I'm right. I want to hear, you know, it's boy, okay. You're right. You. And I thought, wow, even in this, I seek honor for myself. And so Paul says, Abram says, David says, we have got to let that part of our life die. We've got to let a life that seeks honor for ourselves die. It doesn't bring you life, nor anyone else.
It hurts.
It hurts, but then comes the next part, right? Because Abram's faith not only responded to God's faithfulness, not only accepted the reality and necessity of death, of that old life, but Abram's faith trusted God. And this is a different word. This trust is aman, which amen comes from. It's also the name of my OBGYN. Aman means that to trust or confirm someone's faithfulness. Now that makes a big difference, right? Here Abraham has grown, and he now confirms God's faithfulness to acknowledge that to be God, he already said, God, you're God, you're all powerful. But now he's saying to be God means to be faithful. So when I say God, I mean faithful. That's what I mean. So we have Genesis 15. And of course, we have God promising the reward of descendants of a large family. And this is really underneath that Paul is trying to get at is the inheritance is this large family. And you're not receiving that invitation, right, of a large family that I make of this multitude of nations. You're pushing it off, he's telling the Romans. But Abram has this promise of a large family, and Abraham believes in the Lord, that Amon, without putting any restrictions on the gift, without saying, wow, God, thank you, that's a great promise. So how many are you exactly talking about? And when are you going to bring this? And how many are actually going to come from my body and then from the bodies of my bodies? And what are these people going to look like? Am I going to like all these family members? Are these family members going to all be very intelligent and very, I was going to say not A-type, very laid back? Are they going to be the kind of people I want to call family? He doesn't say that, right? He just says, I believe God. I'm not putting any restraints on God. I trust his faithfulness to bring me life from family, right? From this family that he's going to give. So we see Abraham's faith going from responding to God's faithfulness to accepting the necessity of dying under God's faithfulness, that old life, and to trusting God's faithfulness. We see the growth of Abram's faith. And Romans 4, then, Paul inserts, Abraham believed that the presence of God was grace. Whenever Paul talks about the presence of God, this is pretty important. He doesn't mean what we often think. When we say, oh, the presence of God is with me, what do we usually, what's the aspect of God we like about that?
We want to feel him.
Yeah. What? We want to feel him, right? It's definitely an emotional feeling of presence, of really comfort, right? Paul is not talking about a comforting presence here. Nor is he talking about a guiding presence here. When Paul talks, particularly in Romans, about God's presence, he's talking about God's ruling presence. God as the sovereign king. Interesting, one of the women from, I think, the Fort Wayne class emailed me this week and said, so here's a question, what difference would it make in our life if we refer to God as king? And I thought it was just rhetorical. And then I realized, oh, she's really asking, what difference does it make? And here Paul is saying, Abram understands that God's ruling presence is grace. Now, here's the thing. We don't. We say his comforting presence is grace. What a gift for him to comfort me and to make me feel good. We think his guiding presence is grace. Oh, thank you. I didn't know which way to go. Thanks for telling me. But when we say his ruling presence is grace, that means him telling me what is good and what is not. Him telling me, yes, you may, no, you may not. And Abram says, that's a gift. That's grace. To have someone tell you what is right and wrong and to know it. We don't think that's grace. We actually squirm under that. Right? We go, oh, yeah, but God, you don't get it because you're not in my family or you're not in my situation. Abram says his ruling presence is grace.
Joe, is there anyone that recorder keeps the red button?
I have no idea. I'm watching it and I don't know. So Abram trusts that God's rule is going to be faithful to his promise. And that it's going to result in Abram being truly a father of many nations, a large family and a diverse family. When Paul says this, that Abram believes his ruling presence is grace, and that his ruling presence is actually going to bring him a diverse family, a family of many nations. I'm not actually sure many of us would like that. I'm not sure, because when he talks about many nations, he's talking about the diversity of the world. And if God told you beforehand, okay, you're going to have four kids, one of those children is going to be intelligent and he's going to go to school and he's going to be successful. Another one is going to go off the deep end and he is going to just be a challenge for you. And another one is just going to live in your house in your basement for the rest of your life. And another one is think anything you want. That's a diverse family, right? When we think of having children, we think, right, they're all going to be exactly how I picture. And then when they're not, you're like, I don't like that. And Abram's saying, God, you're going to make me the father of a diverse family, a really diverse family, many nations, all sorts of people that I can't control as to what they're going to look like. And I think that is God's faithfulness to me. So he is seeing the picture of God as much bigger than I think we normally do. God, Abraham believes that God is faithful, that he is a faithful God. And he believes that he's a God who's faithful, whose ruling presence is grace, who will then bring him through death. So remember, he's already accepted the reality that his old life has to die. But he believes that God, in his faithfulness, will bring him through death. So Genesis, we have then this whole covenant ceremony of Genesis 15, which is really where I want to go. And I'm looking at the time and thinking, how am I going to get here? How many of you have at least studied some way the covenant ceremony here? Okay, I think we need to go through it. What the covenant ceremony says is God takes on the burden of death. So basically, we have got to go through the death, but God will carry the burdensome backpack full of the supplies that we thought were necessary. So remember the candy village? And we think candy is necessary. And I was going to do this. I was going to fill a backpack with candy that was so heavy that it was hard to carry. But most of that candy is gone. I didn't eat that. But that is what we want to carry with us, right? We thought that was necessary to carry with us. We thought all that honor that we've acquired was necessary to carry with us. And God says, that life has to go, and you have to bring it. But I'm going to carry the pack for you. I'm going to be the one that carries all of the supplies that you thought were necessary. And so God has Abraham do in 15 is he has Abram go and get the supplies. Abram, you go get all that candy. You get all the things that you thought were necessary for life to get you honor. You gather all those and you bring them to me. And you cut them. You kill them. You say, these need to be put to death. But then I'll take it from there. You gather the supplies. And when Abram gathers the supplies, it says, Abram was terrified. Now, he wasn't terrified because it got dark, which it did. He was terrified because he knew what kind of a ceremony was going on when he was told to get these and cut these in half, right? He knew it was a covenant ceremony. And what you should know about a covenant ceremony is that when you split the animals into pieces side by side, that the persons making the covenant are to walk through the blood, right? Remember in this pattern? Mm-hmm. You walk through, you get all bloody. And that is a vow to say what? If I break the covenant,
means death.
Please kill me. It is a request for someone to kill you if you break the covenant. This is why Abram's terrified. God, you're making a covenant? There is no way I can keep this. I'm asking for my own death. That's why Abram is terrified at this. Abraham is then told, look, it's going to be a difficult journey. It's going to be a journey, a long journey. It's not going to be over and done with, which is what we like to think. It's going to be a difficult journey. In fact, your descendants, who Abraham said, this is me, will go 400 years in slavery and oppression. It's going to be hard. It's going to be so hard that there are going to be times that you're going to feel like, I'd rather go back to my old life where I was. I'd rather go back to the honor-shame paradigm where I'm exchanging my glory, where I'm letting my stuff rule, because that's comfortable to me. I know that. I know how to navigate that. In fact, that's exactly what Israel did, right? When Israel was redeemed out of Egypt, out of slavery, they encountered some hardships right away. First of all, they encountered the fact that the Egyptians are running after them. That's scary. And then they get to the Red Sea, and here are the Egyptians behind them, and the sea in front of them, there's nowhere else to go. If you know the geography of the place where they were, there's literally no place to go. They're surrounded by mountains and a path where the Egyptians have taken over and the sea in front of them. That's scary. That's hard. And then, of course, the water's open, and you go, well, isn't that cool? Who wouldn't want to do that? Really? The waters have just opened up in their walls, and you go, oh, cool. No, you go, oh, my. I have to walk through here? Mm-hmm. When are those waters going to fall? Mm-hmm. It's not going to be an easy journey leaving that life behind, that Israel left behind. I really wanted to show you a clip. I think I'll explain it instead because it will take too long. I think this is a great clip. How many of you have seen The Shawshank Redemption? Mm-hmm. Okay, so most of you know the story, right? It's about prisoners. They're in prison. The main character is innocent, but he's been sentenced to life in prison. He actually escapes. And he holds out hope for the friends that he's made in there. And he says, when you get out, I will be there for you. And so the second character actually gets out of prison. After one person has already got out of prison. The first person gets out of prison and he can't deal with it. He doesn't know how to live in the world, right? He's been in prison all of his life. These people are old. They're at least in their 70s. And he can't deal with it, and he commits suicide. The second person, Morgan Freeman, he comes out of prison, and he is working in a grocery store. And, I mean, it's kind of funny and kind of sad because he's working in the grocery store. He's just a bagger. He's like 65, 70 years old. And he keeps on raising his hand to the manager. You remember the scene? Mm-hmm. And the manager, and he says, yes. And he says, I need to go to the bathroom. And the manager says, you don't have to raise your hand to go to the bathroom. And of course, he narrates and says, I don't know how to live any other way. This is how I've lived all the time. Someone has always ruled me, right, in the prison. And he keeps on and he says, I can't make it. I keep on thinking of ways to break my parole. I want to go back where I know how to live. Right? I want to go back to an honor-shame paradigm. I want to go back to a place where I know, where everybody else around me knows how to live. It's much easier to live in that comfortable place, which is exactly what Israel said, right? Can't we go back to Israel or to Egypt where, yes, we were slaves, but at least we had meat pots? That's the whole idea. This Morgan Freeman is, I can't do it. And he said, the only thing that stopped me was a promise I made to Andy, the man who had gotten out, mm-hmm. who said he had hope for me. And so he goes to the place, and the end scene is beautiful because he reads the note about hope that Andy left for him, and money, and a place for him to go to be family. So it's this beautiful idea of the journey's hard leaving the place. So don't think when the scriptures call, when Paul calls, when Abraham calls, when David calls to come out of that life of death, come out of this kind of life, that it's not going to be hard. But Abraham also knows that God will bring us through the death. He doesn't say, oh, you don't have to die. You don't have, you can bring that life along with you. No, he says you have to leave that life alone and trust that I have something better for you, but that God will bring me through that, that God will be with me in that death, which is what the whole circumcision, the whole covenant ceremony means. God doesn't require Abram to walk through the pieces.
Right, that's what I was gonna ask.
He doesn't require him because Instead, he puts him to sleep. You sleep while I do the walk of death, because I will take on the burden and responsibility of the vow. I alone will make the vow. If either of us breaks this covenant, the vow says, I will ask for death for me. And so this, of course, reflects again Genesis 2, where God does the cutting for Abram, puts Adam to sleep. God carries the vow, walks through the pieces. God's presence is symbolized here, of course, by the smoking oven and the flaming torch. And we will see from here on in God symbolizing himself in either smoke or fire. You know that. All throughout, not just Old Testament, but New as well. And we know that Abram's descendants break the covenant. In fact, Abram himself immediately breaks the covenant, right? Because right after this covenant, he lets Sarah talk him into using Haggai. And so we know that Abram's descendants are going to break the covenant. So we know that the vow has to be fulfilled, that God has to take on their request, kill me, because I've taken on the burden. And of course, we understand that it was God in Jesus doing the heavy lifting. He was the one who brought that burden, and he was the one who actually becomes the place that sins are deposited and conquered. And we know that the humanity in Jesus experiences the sins taken away, the sins covered, the sins forgiven. Thus, he's taken through death. And so we have this beautiful picture of, yes, you will all have to go through death, but God will take the burden for you. God will take that heaviness. God will take the vow. Thus, you will be able to be brought through death. And so Romans 4 tells us that the ruling, gracious presence of God would take dead people. And if we apply a functional ontology to this, because remember, that's appropriate because Paul continues to use creation terms. If we take functional ontology to what he's saying, that God is going to take dead people, that means dead people would be those who had once lived, in other words, had once been assigned a function, right? That's what it means to exist, to live. People who had once been assigned a function, but it didn't fulfill that function and therefore died. Who would that be? Who's Paul talking about there? Who is he talking to?
The Jews.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's talking about the Jews who had been given a function in Abraham, right? You've been given a function. You didn't fulfill that function. So you are dead people. And God will take these dead people, but it will be dead people who are willing, an Israel who's willing to recognize that their obedience to the law never brought them life because they manipulated it as a means to acquire honor for themselves, and thus they accept the necessity of death to that life. So he will take dead people who understood the necessity for death to that life, and this ruling gracious presence would call non-existent people. Odd language, right? Except if you know Genesis 1 and 2. Because then it makes sense. Because again, functional ontology, who are non-existent? What does non-existent mean?
People that don't have a function.
Yeah, people that haven't been given a function yet, right? That would have been the non-ordered world.
Like people that don't know the good news yet.
So when he's talking Jews and Gentiles, who has not yet been given
Barbarians?
A function? Who?
Barbarians?
The Gentiles.
The Gentiles. Oh, okay. The Gentiles have not yet been given a function. Israel has. Mm-hmm. Okay. In Jesus, they get a function, right? And so he says, God will take both dead people, non-existent people. Remember, he's talking functional ontology, Genesis language. He will take both of them. He will bring them through death. Abraham believed that God's faithfulness was that he would take both dead people and non-existent people, because he knew that he was going to become a father of many nations. He knew that it wouldn't be just a nation of dead people, in other words, a nation just of Israel, but of many nations.
Was he talking to when the non-existent, like the Gentile believers, or like all Gentiles?
He's always talking about before you were in Christ, you were non-existent, right? Or dead. You were either dead or non-existent, mm-hmm. as far as a functional ontology goes.
Okay.
Abraham also knew that this would be a people, a believing people, who would accept the necessity of death, non-existence. Yes, my life as it was had to die. My life as it was had no purpose. Either one. Because he'd experienced already the reality of him contemplating the death of his own body and Sarah's body, right? He already saw in reality, my body is dead. It can't produce a child. It never has. And by this point, we know that he is older. He is less than 95 years old, older than 75, somewhere in between there. And Sarah's body obviously can't. I mean, if I can't produce a child at 60, Sarah can't, right, at 80. So he knows that the promise is going to have to work with dead people. Abram knows that. You're going to have to work with two dead bodies here. So you're going to have to bring us through death. We're dead. We are unproductive as far as giving children. You're going to have to bring us through this death. And then, of course, trusting that you will bring us to life. So if an Abrahamic faith is one that responds to God's faithfulness, that trusts that God is faithful to bring us through death and into life. Again, not defining what that life looks like, not defining what the death looks like, and not defining what the life looks like, and thus a faith that gets strengthened. So Genesis 15:16. After all this happens, after the covenant ceremony happens, God says to Abraham, so your descendants are going to have this time of going through death. I'm going to bring them through that, because then in the fourth generation, I'm going to bring them back to this land, and I'm going to give that to them. And they will have the land, a place of flourishing that I am going to give them. And Romans 4 would say about that, that the Romans 4:17b and then 20 through 25 says, the promise to Abraham's descendants was to be heir of the world. And I hope you catch what Paul does. He changes this, right? Because Abraham was promised what? A land. Mm-hmm. Paul says, your descendants are promised the world. Why? Why does Paul change it from land to world?
It includes all the Gentiles.
It includes everyone, right? It is expanded. Because if he takes his position seriously, if the descendants of Abram take their position seriously, they're going to expand the flourishing, not just in the land, but out the land, right? And again, it is Genesis language. It is to expand to the whole earth so that heaven can come to earth and God can actually rule and relate without obstacle. The heirs, then, of the world, to be heirs of the world, then, is to have the authority, the glory of God, right? To rule in a representative way, benevolently maintaining and expanding a place of flourishing where God can rule and reign without obstacle. So when Paul talks about inheritance, he's going back to Abram and, of course, increasing that. He does not mean that we get to have a mansion in heaven and just sit around eating bonbons all day. Which is, Which is, unfortunately, a way we kind of promote that, right? Our inheritance is actually the whole world, which, bless you. Our inheritance is the whole world, which means not just the earth, which means we are to rule the earth benevolently, taking care of it, but also all of the people. That's our inheritance. That's the people that we are actually to be family with. We're to look at everyone. When you walk around church, you should be looking at everyone going, oh, you're my relative. Oh, we're all in this together. You're all my inheritance. We are each other's inheritance. Our inheritance is full humanity, that we get to be restored to who we were meant to be, rulers representing God's benevolent rule. Thus, our inheritance is the restoration of life as it was intended, so that he gives life to the dead, Paul says. He reconnects those who were dead, Israel, who had once been connected to life, the life of God, and he calls into existence, again, Genesis language, he calls into existence, he assigns function, purpose, to those who had none or didn't know they had any, and thus connecting them to the life of God, which would have been the Gentiles. And so Paul is talking both to the Jews and the Gentiles through, he says, the resurrection of Jesus our Lord, affording us a reversal then, not just a new life, but a reversal of the life we had been living outside of God. Turn to 1 Peter 1:3. Somebody have it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read it really loudly?
Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Check your coin.
Read one more verse.
To obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you.
He says, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, he's brought us through death into life through the resurrection to give us an inheritance. Remember, that inheritance is the world, our new way of living by ruling as representative of God. And he names this inheritance with three adjectives. And I want you to notice that these three adjectives are the exact opposite of the three adjectives that he uses in Romans 1. First thing is imperishable or incorruptible. It reverses the dishonored, corrupted body of Romans 1. Remember, it says you are given to a dishonored body. Second is undefiled. It reverses the degraded passions and emotions of Romans 1. And lastly, not fading away. Reversing the depraved mind. Remember, the depraved means can't stand the test of truth. It can't stand it. And this life is able to stand and never fade away in the midst of truth. And so the inheritance we get reverses what we were living. It reverses the unfaithful life, and it gives us a faithful life, a life incorruptible, undefiled, and not fading away. With that, with probably one of the more easier chapters, I do want to take 5 minutes here to ask, is anybody found that they, first of all, are you doing it? Are you every night saying, where have I sought honor for myself? Where have I really embraced this honor-shame society that I am seeking honor for myself, that I'm seeking either in that forgiveness part, like I want to hear that I was right, you were wrong. I want to hear that, boy, I'm really good for giving forgiveness. Where have you found those places? Anybody willing to share something there? So none of you have found...
I haven't written any poetry for quite a few years, and I suddenly was thinking about that, and so I got out a bunch of my poetry. In fact, I read all of my poetry from grade school and high school, and then I read all of my poetry about Chuck and about Woody and about Garth and about the mountains, and about the prairie, and there was over 100, and everyone I read, I said, man, am I good.
I should try to publish more of this. I have sent them out occasionally, and some of them have been published, and I've actually probably made $25. You know, you don't get much money for a poem. But so I pulled out 100 strings right away. Every one of them, I thought. This is so good.
Publish so we can read and see how that is.
That's a great example. That's a great example, right?
Yeah, I mean, I trashed it, you know, almost the first day. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Angela?
The reason why I wasn't here last week was because I kind of filled a need of an emergency. A mom that was going to go on this retreat with the sixth graders, and I have a sixth grader, got sick. And so at 9 o'clock at night, the principal was coming. Are calling to see if anyone can do this. And so I ended up saying yes because I was able to arrange some things. But I thought to myself, as people are thanking me and, oh, thanks for like filling in, we really needed someone. I thought, oh, I'm so good. I rescued them. And then I thought, I would never have been able to do this if it hadn't been for my in-laws taking my other two kids that are home. Like, I'm really not that great. I had to have backup and help in order to be able to do this.
Oh, that's good. So, that's good. Okay. Anybody else?
Well, this morning I got in the car and my husband had turned the car around so I wouldn't have to back down the driveway, and I saw some sand and some stuff he dragged in on his feet, and I said, oh, did you drag this? Can you clean this out? It's not like I do anything for you, he said. He does all for me. I felt, yeah, shut your mouth, you know.
Yes, yes. So I want to encourage you to continue on that journey. It's not an easy journey to recognize where we seek honor, where we try to let our minds and our emotions and our body rule us, to leave that. Christ has carried the burden for us, but we still have to go on the journey. And we've got to recognize those places. Without recognizing those places, without acknowledging, what does David say? Without acknowledging those, mm-hmm. our body wastes away. Mm-hmm. Literally, it will waste away. And so, and of course, you know, for me, that forgiveness thing, I still have to do that verbally. Like, I've forgiven, but I'm still in the place where literally coming up with, well, from now on, you're going to have to do this. From now, I mean, I'm wanting to put conditions on that. Mm-hmm. And so I still have to walk through what that looks like for me to acknowledge that this isn't about me getting honor. This is about restoring a relationship. So I would encourage you to do that as we finish rejecting glory, as far as Paul is concerned. Let me pray. Father, thank you. Thank you that you've carried the burden of the sin. Thank you also that as we walk through death, as we walk through letting go of that old life where it's comfortable, letting go of the life that everybody else is living, why shouldn't we? Mm-hmm. Lord, as we let go of that, help us to remember, help us, give us a really good visual picture of you carrying the burden of all of our accumulated honor and throwing it into the fire, and giving us an arm around our shoulder that we might continue to walk through it, knowing that you're bringing us through this to make space for your life in us. Mm-hmm. Father, I pray that we would have more space this week than we've ever had to receive the life you want to give us, that we might celebrate, that we might dance as David even did, that we might, like Abram, experience your faithfulness, that we might trust that you will bring us through death and into life, into a life that reverses the life we've had. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Amen.